Versailles, 100 years ago, the poisonous spirit of vengeance. It's important for us as a Reformation Society to understand Versailles. It's a new story of all new stories. The poisonous spirit of vengeance of Versailles has so badly affected the 20th century. It is impossible actually to understand 20th century history without understanding the disastrous, catastrophic role played by Versailles. The Versailles Treaty, which was signed 28 June 1919, 100 years ago, has to be recognized as the worst failure of a peace treaty ever signed in history. It ushered in a 100 years war. Timed to coincide with the 5th anniversary of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie on their 10th wedding anniversary in Sarajevo by Serbian terrorists, 28 June 1914. Which is credited as being the spark that led to the catastrophic First World War. They timed the signing of the Versailles Treaty to coincide with it, and you'll see how it has been celebrated in many ways. The American President Woodrow Wilson, throughout the First World War, would raise the Serbian flag, the flag of a country that started the First World War by murdering the heir to the throne of Austria and his wife Sophie, would raise it at the White House on the 28th of June. I mean, can you imagine? And they even sent a congratulations to the people of Serbia on the signing of the Versailles Treaty for these brave acts of patriotism and trust that there'd be many in the future. What brave acts? Assassination, terrorism, murder. The Treaty of Versailles was meant to guarantee peace. They actually called it a peace treaty. But it led to the most violent, destructive century in the history of mankind. You cannot understand the history of the Soviet Union, for example, or Eastern Europe, without understanding the pivotal role played by the destructive Versailles Treaty of 28 June 1919. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever man sows, that shall he reap. My view on Versailles and the Second World War and on the First World War and on 20th century history changed dramatically when I began doing Bible smuggling behind the Iron Curtain to Eastern Europe and traveling with Bill Bethlen as far north as Poland, as far south as Yugoslavia and Albania, and the people of Romania and Bulgaria and Poland and Hungary and Romania. They had a very different view of Versailles and the Second World War and Yalta and so on than I'd had. They would say to me, "You betrayed us." "What do you mean? You British and Americans, you betrayed us. What do you mean?" And they explained what I'm going to be getting into now, and forced me to go back to school, back to the books, back to the drawing board, to reevaluate the lies that I've been fed in school textbooks, we've all been, and through the movies. The tragic legacy of Versailles, the Treaty of Versailles, which ended the First World War, not only guaranteed the Second World War, but also led to the destruction of Christian civilization in much of Europe and throughout the world for over a century. It's what led from the greatest century of missions, derailed it into the worst century of persecution. It's vital for us to understand the times, to know what we ought to do in order to effectively work for biblical reformation today, in order to lay solid foundations for future generations. No good building on sand, no good building on mud, no good building on quicksand. You can't build a good future on lies. We have to know the truth. If we do not understand how the greatest century of missions was derailed into the worst century of persecution, we will not be able to extricate ourselves from the morass of secular humanism and the disinformation campaign, which has made generations of Christians be victims of the Stockholm Syndrome. You know what the Stockholm Syndrome is? Kidnapping term, when people who have been kidnapped or hijacked come to actually identify with the kidnappers who hold their lives in their hands. Embracing our chains, singing the praises of the enemies of God who've been ripping up the foundations of Christian civilization while brainwashing our children down a self-destructive path. That's the Stockholm Syndrome. As we mark the 100th anniversary of the end of the Versailles Treaty, it's absolutely vital if we understand the destructive legacy of what has to be recognized as the most destructive, the most counterproductive treaty in the history of the world. To rob the needy of justice, and to take what is right from the poor of my people, that widows may be their prey, that they may rob the fatherless. We read in Isaiah 10 verse 2. United States Secretary of State Lansing said of the peace treaty, that he and President Woodrow Wilson brought home, the Versailles Treaty menaces the existence of civilization. French Marshal Ferdinand Foch said of Versailles, "This is not peace, it's an armistice for 20 years. Pretty accurate. Injustice, arrogance, displayed in the hour of triumph will never be forgotten or forgiven," said British Prime Minister Lloyd George at the end of this treaty, which he was a key architect of. Lord Arthur Balfour of the Balfour Declaration declared, "These three all-powerful, all-ignorant men," referring to Lloyd George of England, Clemenceau of France, Woodrow Wilson of America, "these three all-powerful, all-ignorant men sitting there, carving continents, with only a child to lead them." To understand this, you've got to try and understand it from the German perspective and from the Eastern European and Christian European perspective. After Germany had decisively defeated the Italians at Caporetto, remember, Germany wasn't fighting a two-front war, they were fighting a four-front war. I often speak about the two-fronts war, but there was the Western Front, there was the Eastern Front, then there was the Romanian Front, and the Serbian Front, and there was also the Italian Front. So Germany actually was fighting a five-front war, actually, if you want to be accurate about it. And they were victorious. After Germany decisively defeated the Italians at Caporetto, in fact, it was Lieutenant Erwin Rommel who was the architect of that victory, and he got his Blue Max for that, the highest award that Imperial Germany could give for that, and he started rising up the ranks. Interesting, in Second World War, he was expected to fight to aid his previous enemies, the Italians. And after the Germans defeated Romania and Russia in early 1918, a million German soldiers had been released to join their comrades on the Western Front for the last great German offensive of the war, the Western Offensive. Here you've got a picture, First World War, aerial warfare, trenches, barbed wire, machine guns, gas, flamethrowers, tanks. By April 1918, Ludendorff's armies were back on the Marne River in France, and Field Marshal Sir Douglas Haig, head of the British forces, was issuing the order, "With our backs to the wall, each of us must fight to the end. Every position must be held to the last man. There must be no retirement." The British were staring defeat in the face. But America upset the balance of power in Europe. In the end, the Americans proved decisive. By spring 1918, 300,000 American soldiers were in France. By summer, a million. With fresh troops moving up the front lines at a quarter of a million a month, German morale sank. For 4 years they've been fighting and winning, and the stalemate on all these fronts was now broken by the American involvement. What Woodrow Wilson called the war to end all wars. On 5th of October 1918, Prince Max of Baden sounded out President Wilson on a peace based on the 14 points that he had laid out in January. 3 days later, Wilson asked Prince Max, would Germany accept the points? On October the 12th, Prince Max gave assurances objective of entering into discussions would be only to agree upon practical details for the application of the 14 points to a Treaty of Peace. Now, Woodrow Wilson offered a 14-point program for peace without any victors, without any vanquished, to end the madness, to stop the fighting, to go back to the drawing board, and no reapportioning of territories, but self-determination of the people concerned to determine where the boundaries would lie, and no violence, no reparations, no apportioning of guilt, and no indemnities, no charging of people to pay for war reparations, infractors. Let's just recognize it's been a very bad thing, which is actually what the Kaiser offered in 1915, 1916. So now the American president, a neutral, had offered it. Of course, Germany was all for it. But now roadblocks came to peace. Wilson began to add conditions. Safeguards must be provided to guarantee Allied military supremacy. A democratic and representative government must be established, which they really had. Germany had a parliament. The Kaiser had to go. Why? Well, you need a scapegoat. Prince Max agreed. Sacrificial lamb of the Kaiser. 23rd of October, Wilson took the German peace offer to the Allies, and the British and French After 4 years of bloodletting that had cost them together more than 2 million dead, 6 million wounded, they balked at what they called Wilson's mild terms. They wanted blood. Here's just one of the categorizations of the casualties in the war. How great was this war? Total mobilized, killed and died, wounded, prisoners and missing, total casualties. Percentage of those mobilized casualties. Russia mobilized 12 million, 1.7 million killed or died of wounds and injuries. Nearly 5 million wounded, prisoners 2.5 million, total casualties more than 9 million. 76% of the mobilized men casualties. Go down to France, 8 million mobilized. They also had 76% casualties. The British Empire, literally 8,900,000 mobilized, of which 908,000 were killed and died, 2 million wounded, 191,000 prisoners, total casualties over 3 million, 35% casualties. You go down to Germany, 11 million mobilized, 1.7 million killed, 4 million wounded, over a million prisoners or missing, 7 million casualties in total, 64% casualties. 64% of those mobilized either killed, died of wounds, wounded, or prisoners. Absolutely catastrophic. So you look at this, the grand total of 65 million Europeans mobilized, 8.5 million being killed, 21 million wounded, 7 million prisoners, more than that, 37 million total casualties, 57%, more than half of all those mobilized were casualties of one sort or another. Catastrophic. Under a threat from Colonel House, he's an American, of a separate peace, America's going to make a separate peace with Germany. That forced the British Prime Minister Lloyd George to agree, but he gave one reservation. Britain will not agree to the second of Wilson's 14 points, freedom of the seas. Nope. The Royal Navy must be free to do whatever necessary to ensure British domination on the seas. So forget freedom of the seas. Now the demands start to escalate, especially from the French. France succeeded in inserting a clause claiming full compensation for all damage done to allies and their property by Germany by land, sea, and or air. Not like everyone hadn't been causing damage to one another. I mean, that was the whole point of the war. It's like at the end of a Grand Prix race, you start handing out speeding tickets to some of the people who participated. This is what led to the crime of 11 November. Matthias Erzberger, the leader of the Catholic Center Party, who had urged fellow Germans to agree to armistice, was given the thankless task of meeting Marshal Ferdinand Foch, the Allied Supreme Commander, signing the armistice. Now, an armistice is not a surrender. Armistice is agreement to lay down weapons for a mutually agreed peace. In Compiègne Forest on November the 11th, and came into effect at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, 1918. In 1921, Erzberger would be murdered, assassinated in the Black Forest for the crime of November 11th. He is seen by his people as a traitor. Not that he could have foreseen what would have come from it, because the 14 points was reasonable, and if they stuck to it, he wouldn't have been a traitor, but because it was abused, he got blamed. This is an interesting map, because this shows the colors of the flags of those countries, the Russian Empire. South Africa at that point was under the red flag, the British Ensign with the Union Jack in the corner, and so on. So you can see just the different countries around the world. See the German East Africa flag, the German Southwest Africa flag, and so on. Just gives you a bit of an idea how much France controlled. And Canada's flag back then was also British Ensign, where the Union Jack's in the corner of a red flag. In Great Britain, a khaki election was called. Now, they've got millions in khaki uniform, and the government wants to exploit the triumph of war's end. In Britain, unlike America, they don't have a set day of the year when they're going to have elections. The government can call election any time within 4 years. And sometimes you get them calling it a snap election early because, for example, Theresa May recently thought she could increase her majority and actually lost the majority. It doesn't always work out the way the government's planning. But basically, when your country's just won a war, the government in power will win the next election. So just to take that opportunity right there and then. For example, George Bush Sr. had something like a 90% approval rating after winning the Gulf War in 1991. And if he had gone for an election then, he would have swept the board. But a few years later, he's unpopular again, he lost the election. Just when you call an election, according to the economy and according to the wars, generally determines who wins the election. Lloyd George began his campaign, he's the British Prime Minister, 12th of November, one day after the armistice, with a statesman-like call for a magnanimous, meaning a gracious, generous peace. We must not allow any sense of revenge, any spirit of greed, any grasping desire to overrule the fundamental principles of righteousness. Vigorous demands will be made to Hector and bully the government in the endeavor to make them depart from the strict principles of right and satisfy some base, sordid, squalid idea of vengeance and avarice. Avarice, basic greed. We must relentlessly set our faces against that. This echoes Micah 6 verse 8. He has shown you, man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? But to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. But a new theme came through the newspapers. Lloyd George had misread the mood of his country, and of the press baron, Alfred Lord Northcliffe, the Napoleon of Fleet Street, they called him. Fleet Street's where all newspapers came from. Whipped up by Northcliffe's papers, the public rejected such noble statements. They took up the cry, hang the Kaiser. Why? Well, didn't matter. Forget about logic. Extortion came into it. Ever attentive to popular opinion, Lloyd George was soon pledging to bring home a peace in which Germany would be made to pay the full cost of the war. All sides of the war. They would pay to the utmost farthing, he roared. We will search their pockets for it. We will squeeze the lemon until the pips squeak, was the theme of one Liberal candidate. This was the worst parliament in British history, they say. The parliament elected that December that gave Lloyd George a majority of 340 out of 400 seats, the greatest in British history, has been described as one of the most insular, reactionary and benighted in the annals of Westminster. Stanley Baldwin described them as hard-faced men who looked like they'd done well at the war. In other words, they were war profiteers. There was a vendetta in Westminster. From the House of Commons to Lloyd George came a letter signed by 237 coalition members, a vengeance telegram demanding the utmost severity for Germany. The signers wanted every last pound of German flesh, apparently oblivious to the consequences of such punitive actions that they were demanding. Now you see the depravity of man. The khaki election of 1918 and the peace of vengeance that British voters demanded that Lloyd George bring home validates insights of George Kennan. Suffering does not always make man better. People are not always more reasonable than governments. Public opinion is not invariably a moderating force in the jungle of politics. There was no mercy. This is a picture of a French occupying soldier in the Rhineland, in the Saar, pointing his rifle and bayonet at some grandfather, unarmed civilian. Why would you do that? It just shows the mentality. Arriving in Paris with a mandate for no mercy, Lloyd George found his resolve to impose a harsh peace more than matched by George Clemenceau, whose ravaged nation of France had lost 1.3 million of its people killed in the war. Clemenceau had one great love, France, and one great hate, Germany. Clemenceau was determined to impose on La Boche a treaty that would cripple Germany. His fear and hatred were caught in the remark that 20 million Germans too many. Hey, just think of today we've got Bill Gates, is it, who says that there's 6 billion too many people in the world. We need to reduce the world's population down to ideally about 100 million. Well, presumably he plans to be part of that 100 million privileged bunch, and he's the one who's promoting vaccinations and abortions and all these other things dramatically, and puts billions of dollars into that campaign. What do people mean when they say there's so many millions, too many people? Well, it's actually, they're talking about genocide. Romans 1, verse 31 to 32 sums it up. Undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death. not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. It was a terrible treaty. Democracy is more vindictive than cabinets. The wars of peoples will be more terrible than those of kings. And this is true. Kings can be so much more ready to forgive than peoples in the streets. And the peace the people demanded and got in 1919 would prove more savage. For it is easier for despotic monarchs to forget their hatreds than for democratic statesmen or peoples. Just think of the first exiles of democracy. The day of the trial of Jesus in Jerusalem. Who shall I release? This Barabbas revolutionary terrorist murderer? Or Jesus of Nazareth? Release Barabbas, crucify Christ. His blood be upon us and upon our children. That's democracy. They choose Barabbas and they crucify Christ. This is in great contrast to Vienna. At the end of the 25 years of French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, the Congress of Vienna in 1815, Castlereagh of England, Metternich of Austria, Alexander I of Russia, and Frederick William III of Prussia, the coalition that had destroyed Napoleon's empire, sat down at the same table with Napoleon's foreign minister, Talleyrand, to create new structures to ensure peace for Europe. And in fact, the boundaries they drew were pretty good boundaries, and they held for almost a century. And with the exception of South Eastern Europe, which was under control of the Ottoman Empire, where there were lots of wars to free them from the Ottoman Turks, creating free countries of Romania and Bulgaria and Greece and so on later. But aside from South, the Balkans, as they call it, the Southeast, and Italy that united itself as well, but the other boundaries basically held, showing that the Peace of Vienna was far more successful. Now, some people say, well, the reason why the Peace of Vienna was so successful, compared to the Peace of Versailles, is that Peace of Vienna, there were no American representatives, which isn't actually fair, because Woodrow Wilson wasn't the only problem. Clemenceau and Lloyd George were also the problem. There were a lot of problems there. So you can't just blame the Americans. But still, Versailles was a disaster. Vienna was super successful. In fact, British troops wouldn't have to come into Europe again for another 99 years after the Battle of Waterloo. So the Congress of Vienna was one of the most successful peace treaties in history, which is something that should have been studied by the people at Versailles. Also, you can contrast Versailles with the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. When Germany defeated Russia, they, and that was the biggest front, of course, was the Eastern Front. And Germany had advanced this far into Russia. And Germany had liberated Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Belarus, Poland, Ukraine, all the way down to Georgia. Even the Crimea was under German control. When they stopped at Brest-Litovsk, there it is, and what used to be Poland, and now is part of Russia, and they sat down at Brest-Litovsk, the Germans and the Russians and the Austrians negotiated the terms which gave self-determination and freedom to Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Georgia, Poland, and Ukraine. You look at that on the map and you think, how advanced. In fact, that looks very much like what the map of Europe looks like today. The trouble is, Versailles undid this, forced the Germans to hand all this back to the Soviets, and Ukraine was betrayed twice, in the First World War and the Second World War, by the Allies, as the people told me there. And Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and Poland, and others told me how they were betrayed by the Allies after they'd been liberated by the Germans twice. But though Germany's fate was to be decided at Versailles, you see here the Russians, the Germans, and the Austrians sitting at the same table, no German was invited to Versailles, for the Allies came to Paris to punish them as the guilty nation responsible for destroying the peace that just about every country had taken part in. It was sights like this that excited the indignation of Germans. A war hero with an iron cross, amputated leg, having to sit on the street corner begging to survive after the so-called Weimar Republic came in. As America entered the war on the 2nd of April 1917, Woodrow Wilson declared, "We have no quarrel with the German people. We have no feeling towards them but one of sympathy and friendship. It was not upon their impulse that the government acted in entering upon this war." Now, that's an intelligent comment, but that's not the way they were talking at Versailles. they brought about a savage peace. You can see here the blue areas indicate the alliance of what they call the Central Powers, and the beige represents the allies. When German representatives were summoned to Paris to receive the terms of the treaty, they were stunned to find the amputations that was to be forced upon them. Eupen and Malmedy was to be taken from Germany and given to Belgium. Alsace and Lorraine were to be annexed by France. Now, remember that Alsace and Lorraine includes towns like Strasbourg, which has been German for centuries, which was German for more than a millennium, which is where Gutenberg's Bible was printed. You walk into places like Strasbourg and you can see it's German. The cathedrals, the design of the houses, everything, it's like the Rhineland, but it's in France. And you see German people are speaking French. Alsace and Lorraine was always German. And the fact that Napoleon conquered and made it part of France, well, the Germans took it back in 1871. The Saar, which was the coal and industrial part of Germany, was placed under League of Nations de facto given to France, and France looted it for the next 15 years. The 650,000 Germans who lived in the Saar region were granted the right in 15 years' time to vote on whether they wish to return to Germany, but if they so decide, Germany must then pay to buy back their own mines from France, who had just looted it for 15 years. In Schleswig, that's way up here in Jutland, just south of Denmark, a plebiscite was to be held to divide the land with Denmark. The East Prussian port of Memel was to be seized by Lithuania. Only on the insistence of British Prime Minister Lloyd George, who reportedly said he had no more transport Upper Silesia to the Poles than he'd give a clock to a monkey. There they held a plebiscite, a referendum, which had been under German sovereignty for centuries. In the plebiscite, 60% of people voted to stay with Germany, but still they carved 5/6 of the industrial area and almost all the mines given to Poland, despite the majority of the population choosing to stay with Germany. It's a tragic farce. A disgusted British observer, Sir Robert Donald, called the plebiscite a tragic farce and the stripping of Upper Silesia from Germany as robbery under arms. Here you can see the German territorial losses being given to Poland, given to Lithuania, effectively given to France, or ceded to Czechoslovakia, which hadn't existed before the war. The port city of Danzig, German for centuries, was declared a free city, placed under League of Control administration, but effectively Polish control. East Prussia was separated from Germany by a Polish corridor, where more than a million Germans were now under Warsaw rule, just to give them a link to the sea, which they hadn't had before. It was robbery under arms. Versailles stripped Germany of 1/10 of its people and 1/8 of their territory in Europe, all of their territory in Africa and in Asia and the Pacific Islands. Proverbs 23 verse 10 says, "Do not remove the ancient landmark. Do not enter the fields of the fatherless." It was wholesale theft. Germany's overseas empire, the third largest on earth after Britain and France, was wholly confiscated. All private property of German citizens and German colonies like South East Africa, German East Africa, Tanganyika, and Cameroon and Togo was declared forfeit to the crown. Expropriation without compensation. Farms, homes, the lot. Japan was awarded the German concessions in Shantung and all German islands north of the equator, the so-called Bismarck Archipelago in the Pacific, given to either Japan or New Zealand or Australia. Germany's Africa colonies were now divided among South Africa, Britain and France. These are some pictures of the German Schutztruppe and Marines operational in Tanganyika and German East Africa, the Askari, and Germany brought a lot of civilization very quickly. If you go and visit Southwest Africa, you can see that although they were only there for a short while, they built a lot of castles, a lot of roads, and in fact, the greatest game reserve on earth was declared by Kaiser Wilhelm II at Toshapan, the first, before President Kruger opened up the Swabi Game Reserve, which became the Kruger Park, before Teddy Roosevelt and Yosemite National Park and so on, Kazavilam was the first great conservationist king. In fact, Etosha Park was four times its present size when Germany controlled Duitse Südwestafrika, and this was all forfeit. There was a lot of double standards. Germany's rivers were now internationalized and open to Allied imports, but Germany was denied equal access to Allied markets. Their military was now to be dismembered and disarmed. Everything. Territories cut away, colonies gone, Germany was to have her limbs broken so that she could not fight again. She is forbidden to ever again have any armored cars, tanks, heavy artillery, submarines, or even an airport. Not so much as a spotter plane. Germany was to remain defenseless, surrounded by well-armed enemies and neighbors. Her high seas fleet was seized as war booty, as was the German merchant fleet. The navy was to consist now of only six small battleships, six light cruisers, 12 destroyers, 12 torpedo boats. The general staff was abolished. This at the time that the British had something like 1,000 warships. The army was restricted to 100,000 men, while the neighbors had millions. Germany was to remain forever vulnerable to her enemies. It was sickening extortion. Goaded on by Lord Northcliffe's press, what they called the yellow press, because the paper would tend to turn yellow, called the yellow press, Lloyd George campaigned for Germany to be made to bear the full cost of the war, including pensions for Allied soldiers, lifetime pensions. But Wilson's public pledge of no indemnities had to be circumvented, and someone else would have to persuade Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, the American president, because the president came to detest the British Prime Minister, Lloyd George. After listening to another shift of position by the Welsh witch, as Lloyd George was called, the US president blurted out, "Mr. Prime Minister, you make me sick." So they might have smiled for the cameras, but they didn't particularly like one another behind closed doors, it would seem. One thinks of 2 Peter 2:19. While they promised them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. It was a vindictive peace which guaranteed war. John Maynard Keynes, who was with the British delegation, returned home to write The Economic Consequences of the Peace, I think the first book ever written on Versailles, which charged the Allied leaders of crafting a vindictive peace which must, by crushing Germany with debt, set the stage for a new war. And it turned out he was dead right. He wrote this already in 1919. And by the way, why was Germany forced to sign this in the Palace of Mirrors, in the Hall of Mirrors, in the Palace of Versailles? Because in 1871, after Germany had defeated France in the German-Franco-Prussian War of 1870 to 1871, Germany had signed the peace treaty with France, where they had to give back Alsace and Lorraine to Germany, in the Hall of Mirrors, in the Palace of Versailles. And to add insult to injury, the Chancellor of Germany, the Iron Chancellor, Otto Bismarck, depicted here in white uniform, Otto Bismarck negotiated in this Palace of Mirrors with the different German kings and princes to recognize the Prussian king as the Emperor of Germany. And this, of course, stung the French, that their weak German neighbor that they had invaded multiple times, ransacked across in the 30 Years' War, the 7 Years' War, the Napoleonic Wars, looted and pillaged and destroyed Germany over and over and over, that now Germany would unite its many different little kingdoms under one empire, and they would do it after having defeated Napoleon III, who had declared war on Germany. I mean, France was the aggressor. And they did it in the Palace of Mirrors. So you see how things sort of go. There's a lot of symbolism. Just like the Japanese began the war with America by sinking the battleships. So the Americans forced the Japanese at the end of the war to come onto a battleship in Tokyo Bay to sign the peace. There's this kind of symbolism. You'll see more of it later. Then there was a reparation scam. The British were behind the scheme to include pensions and reparations. This has never been done in the history of the world before. But for the damage done to the British Isles by aerial or naval attack was so minimal, and the confiscation of Germany's merchant fleet had more than replaced British loss at sea, Britain was entitled maybe to perhaps as much as 1 or 2% of reparations, if such was even ethically right. However, Germany could be made to make the pensions of millions of British soldiers for the rest of their lives Britain's share of reparations could soar to more than 20%. But including pensions would also triple the reparations bill for Germany. $55 billion, you know, gold marks. It was fraudulent idealism. Lloyd George now enlisted South Africa's Jan Smuts, a lawyer who one historian called the great operator of fraudulent idealism, to persuade Woodrow Wilson that forcing Germany to fund the pensions bailout solves would not violate his pledge of no reparations, which is quite a bit of mental gymnastics there. It was illogical. An outraged US delegation implored Woodrow Wilson to veto this reparations bill, arguing it did not follow logically from any of his 14 points. Logic? Logic? I don't give a damn about logic, snarled Wilson. I'm going to include pensions. This is a man who promised to be the outside neutral, the war to end all wars, to guarantee democracy, no reparations, no victors, no vanquished. Henry White, one of the five members of the official United States delegation, reflected the dejection and disillusionment of the idealistic Americans. We had such high hopes of this adventure. We believed God called us. And now we're doing hell's dirtiest work. In 1920, the Allies would set the final bill for reparations at 32 billion gold marks, an absolutely impossible sum for anyone, even the greatest industrial nation on earth. Isaiah 61 verse 8, for I, the Lord, love justice, I hate robbery and iniquity. Why has the 20th century been such a colossal, disgraceful shambles of a mess? Look no further than Versailles. God hates robbery and injustice. Then there was the myth of war guilt. Under Article 231 of the treaty, the war guilt clause, Germany was forced to confess to and accept full responsibility for causing the war and all the damage done. Under Article 227, the Kaiser was declared a war criminal to be arrested and prosecuted. He was given sanctuary in Netherlands, who would not extradite him, to their credit, forcing the Germans to confess to an historic crime and to agree to a lie that they alone were to blame for the war was as foolish as it was unjust. Here's the War Guilt Clause 231. The Allied and Associate Governments affirm, and Germany accepts, the responsibility of Germany and her allies for causing all the loss and damage to which Allied and Associate Governments and their nationals have been subjected as a consequence of the war imposed on them by the aggression of Germany and her allies. This has never been done in any treaty at the end of any war in history before. This is absolutely unprecedented. And Kaiser Wilhelm was not a warmonger. By 1914, Kaiser Wilhelm II had been in power for 25 years and he had never fought a war. Now, in that same time, Winston Churchill had fought many wars. In fact, you read Winston Churchill's his own biography on the war in Afghanistan. He said, we went into this village of Afghans, and when we left, there wasn't one person alive, man, woman, or child. We killed them all. He speaks about shooting the wounded after the Battle of Omdurman, which he is part of the last cavalry charge, and the British divisional cavalry charge. He speaks about supporting the scorched earth concentration camp policies in the Anglo-Boer War. He had been involved in so many personal wars, and as Home Secretary, he ordered the tanks in to open fire on the civilians in Dublin, in Ireland, during the Troubles there. He ordered poison gas to be dropped on Kurdish tribesmen up in Iraq when he was the colonial secretary, because they wouldn't pay their taxes and things like that. Winston Churchill was a warmonger. He was the one who wanted the First World War and the Second World War and worked for as First Lord Admiralty in the First World War, as First Lord Admiralty in the Second as well at the beginning. But Kaiser Wilhelm had never started a war, ever. In the two Moroccan crises, he was the one who backed down. Now, if you look here at the allocation of funds, you can see the circles indicate peacetime budgets converted to US dollars in 1914. And then the columns indicate the number of men under arms. So Britain looks like they don't have a very big military. It's only 338,000. But notice they're spending more money than Germany, $395 million But that's because the Navy is very expensive. And they're putting not a lot of men, but they're a lot of money into the Navy, which is the greatest Navy on Earth. Germany has an army not much bigger than that of France, and France's population is a lot less, and France and Germany are both spending exactly the same amount of money on their armies. Italy has a smaller amount. Austria-Hungary, almost half the amount of Germany. But Russia's got an army almost double the size, and they are involved in not quite double, but almost double the amount of money putting into the Russian army as Germany was. So Germany is not a militaristic giant in Europe, even though she had a population about double that of France. She didn't have a larger army or larger amount of expenditure than France had even, and a lot less than Russia. And she basically had enemies on each of her borders. You look at the British Empire, and you see how much territory the British occupied. Now, they're saying Kaiser Wilhelm's a warmonger and an imperialist who wants to dominate the world. That's what Britain's doing, that's what France is doing, that's what Russia and America's doing. But Germany didn't have much to compare with what the British had conquered. Did these countries just plead with the British to come there? Well, some countries did ask Britain to come and provide them with a protectorate, like Lesotho, Swaziland, Lawsiland. There were some places that asked the British to come and protect them from slavery and Nigeria and so on, but a lot of these places were actually invaded or conquered. Though Kaiser Wilhelm had given the Austrians support to act against the rogue states of Serbia that was terror sponsoring, when the Archduke Franz Ferdinand was murdered by Serb terrorists on the 28th of June, by the last days of July there was no monarch in Europe trying more desperately to stop Europe's plunge to war than Kaiser Wilhelm. Nobody did more to try and stop the war than Kaiser Wilhelm. It wasn't Kaiser Wilhelm's idea. It wasn't his initiative. It was the Serbian government who gave the weapons and the training and the money to the terrorists who murdered Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the heir to the Austrian throne, his wife, on the 10th wedding anniversary in Sarajevo. Serbia started the attack. Russia mobilized against Austria. Germany mobilized against Russia in support of Austria. France mobilized against Germany, and then Britain mobilized against Germany. Kaiser Wilhelm was one in the chain. He wasn't the initiator, and he certainly wasn't the sole responsible agent. In 1914, Kaiser Wilhelm II said, "It's not I who bears the responsibility for the disaster which now threatens the entire civilized world." His head of the Navy, Admiral Tirpitz, said, "This war is really the greatest lunacy ever committed by the white races." I could say a big, heavy amen to that. The biggest, stupidest, dumbest, most insane, suicidal action in the history of Christian civilization was the First World War. Totally unnecessary. "He who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the just, both of them alike are an abomination to the Lord." Proverbs 17:15. The effect on the German psyche of forcing the nation to confess to a crime that Germans did not believe that they had committed was poisonous. There is no better way to generate hatred than by forcing a person to sign an admission of guilt which he sacredly believes is untrue. The wanton humiliation, unprecedented up to that time in the annals of Christendom, created a thirst for justice. Never in history, before 1919, had any treaty that ended the war tried to assign all guilt on the defeated group and force them to sign such a confession of guilt. Why do you do this? The reason is because the First World War invented propaganda. The war for the mind. British historian Russell Grenfell wrote, "The forced admission of a German war guilt in the Treaty of Versailles would have been a colossal political blunder, even if it had been true." And it was not true. Today, most people do not appreciate what Versailles meant to the Germans, who triumphant in the East believed they'd laid down their arms and accepted an armistice and peace in the West based on Woodrow Wilson's 14 points with the United States guaranteeing it. No victors, no vanquished, no reparations, no assigning of territories, only self-determination of peoples. British Labour leader Sir Roy Denham offered this analogy. These terms are difficult to bring home to British readers. But supposing that Britain had lost the U-boat war in 1917 and Germany had imposed an equivalent peace, it would have meant British recognition that its policies of encirclement of Germany had caused the war, confiscation of British colonies and the British merchant fleet, Dover and Portsmouth occupied, the Royal Navy reduced to half a dozen destroyers, southeastern England demilitarized, Liverpool a free port, a corridor under German rule to Harwich, crippling reparations. No post-war British government would have accepted this indefinitely. Why did the Germans sign such a disastrous, disgraceful peace? Germany faced invasion and death by starvation if she refused. She had demobilized the armies. She was at their mercy. Her merchant fleets and even her Baltic fishing vessels had been sequestered. The starvation blockade was still in force. Germany could not feed her people. When Berlin asked permission to buy 2.5 million tons of food, the request was denied. For 8 months after the war ended, the blockade remained in force. 8 months. The war ended on the 11th of November 1918. The blockade continued till the 12th of July 1919. 8 months of starving hundreds of thousands of people to death, civilians, after the war was over. From November the 11th through the peace conference, the blockade was maintained. Before going to war, America denounced as a violation of international law and human decency the British naval blockade that kept the vital necessities of life even out of neutral ports in case some of those goods could be transshipped to Germany or Austria. Now, you were allowed to prevent weapons of war and munitions getting to the enemy. You're never allowed by the Hague and Geneva Conventions to prevent food reaching civilians. But that's what the British did during the Anglo-Boer War, destruction of the farms, and that's what they did now with Germany. When the Americans declared war, a U.S. admiral told Lord Balfour, "You will find it'll only take us 2 months to become as great criminals as you are." U.S. ships now supported the blockade that America had been condemning up till then. "Once lead this people into war," Woodrow Wilson said in 1917, "and they'll forget there ever was such a thing as tolerance." And it's true, during a war, you learn actually to hate the enemy. That's what the propaganda tries to distill, so that you don't even see the enemy as a human being. You don't even want to look at the reasons why they might be fighting, or that your side might have done anything to cause this. This is what Woodrow Wilson wrote after the end of his presidency. "I'm a most unhappy man. I've unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is controlled by a system of credit. Our system of credit is concentrated. The growth of the nation, therefore, in all activities are in the hands of a few men, the banksters. We have come to be one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled and dominated governments in the civilized world, no longer a government by free opinion, no longer a government by conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men." What is he talking about? The Federal Reserve, which, as Stephen Mitford Goodson, once director of the Federal Reserve Bank, said, "The Federal Reserve Bank is not federal, has no reserves, and it's not a bank." It was a war against civilians. America did forget about tolerance. The blockade was responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of men, women, and children, actually hundreds of thousands, after the Germans laid down their weapons and surrendered their warships. Its architect and chief advocate had been First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill. Churchill said, "Our aim is to starve the whole population, men, women, and children, old and young, wounded and sound, into submission." It was war in peace. The war was over. But on the 3rd of March 1919, 4 months after Germany accepted an armistice and laid down their arms and demobilized the armies, Churchill rose exultant in the House of Commons to declare, "We are enforcing the blockade with rigor, and Germany is very near starvation." It was worse than war. There's a picture of children in Austria under starvation. You might know that Emily Hobhouse, who alerted the world to what the British were doing in the concentration camps in South Africa, she was mobilizing British opinion and aid to neutral countries to try and get food to the people starving in Austria and Germany, and being called a traitor in her country for doing so. 8th of March 1919, Daily News wrote, "The birth rate in the great towns of Germany has changed place with the death rate. It is tolerably certain that more people have died amongst the civilian population from blockade than have died in the battlefield." And they're reporting this with joy. You see, our Navy's winning the war by starving the civilians. Even the entreaties of brave little Belgium, for whom the British had said they'd gone to war, fell on deaf ears. Herbert Hoover, who would be credited with saving a starving Belgian, he won the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts in helping the starving during and after the First World War, spent as much time arguing with the British about getting food to Belgians, wrote US historian Thomas Fleming. The poor little Belgium of British propaganda meant little to the British admirals and bureaucrats because they were blockading them. Churchill, who favoured letting the Belgians starve and blaming the Germans, called Hoover, who later became American President Herbert Hoover, a son of a bitch for trying to deliver food to starving civilians. Can you imagine? That's Winston Churchill. Americans have been brought up not to kick a man in the stomach after he had licked him, said Hoover. We have not been fighting women and children, and we're not beginning now. That's what Herbert Hoover said. Put in charge of all relief efforts, Herbert Hoover wanted to feed the starving Germans, but his Congress refused to allow it. In February 1919, US Congress appropriated $100 million for food, but Germany was not to get one loaf of bread, not one bowl of soup. Bearing in mind that 1/8 of all Americans are German by descent, and at the beginning of the war, America was more sympathetic for Germany than it were for Britain. But at the beginning of the war, the British cut the transatlantic cables, cutting all communication between Germany and America, and then the Americans only got the British side of the war and the French side of the war for the rest of the war. And so they imperceptibly changed their views. So at the beginning of the war, there was more sympathy with Germany and less for Britain, and at the end of the war, they were saying we mustn't even give a bowl of soup or a loaf of bread to the Germans. Our Lord Jesus Christ said, "For I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink." These are words he'll use on the Day of Judgment. So severe was the suffering that on 10th of March, the British commander on the Rhine publicly urged that food be sent to the population as the spectre of starving children was damaging the morale of his British troops. General Sir Herbert Plumer's letter was read to the Big Three in Paris. "Please inform the Prime Minister that, in my opinion, food must be sent into this area by the Allies without delay. The mortality amongst women, children, and the sick is most grave, and sickness due to hunger is spreading. The attitude of the population is one of despair, and the people feel that an end by bullets is preferable to death by starvation." His troops, the General Plumer, by the way, notice this is Cologne Cathedral, and here's the British Mark IV tanks in the Rhineland occupying. His troops, the General Plumer, could no longer stand the sight of hordes of skinny and bloated children pouring over offal from British cantonments. In other words, going into dustbins to find something to eat. Pope Benedict XV's plea for an end to the blockade was also ignored. And of course, Emily Hobhouse's pleas. One visitor to Germany who's witnessing it all wrote, "The starvation is done quietly and decently at home. And when death comes, it comes in the form of influenza, tuberculosis, heart failure, or one of the new and mysterious diseases caused by the war, and carries off its exhausted victims. In Frankfurt, even as late as March 1920, the funerals never ceased all day." In 1938, a British diplomat in Germany was asked repeatedly, "Why did England go on starving our women and children long after the armistice?" Good question. Freedom and bread would become a powerful slogan in the ascent to power of the new National Socialist Workers' Party. Decades later, Herbert Hoover, a former president and senior statesman, was still decrying the post-armistice starvation blockade of Germany as a wicked thrust of Allied militarism and punishment that constituted a dark chapter in human history. You know, at the beginning of the 20th century, the most respected people on earth were the Boers. The most despised people on earth were the British because of what they were doing to the Boers. President Paul Kruger was the most honored statesman in the world, and sympathy in the world was all for the Boers and all against the British. During and after the First World War, there was an absolute revulsion around the world for the British, for this hunger blockades, this terrible atrocity and so on. And so you've got to understand the influence of propaganda that could have got to the stage where the British suddenly were the leaders of the free world and Germany was the worst and the Boers were even more demonic. The power of the media to switch people's perceptions, to demonize the victims and to victimize the villains. I'm quoting from Herbert Hoover's law, "Nations can take philosophically the hardships of war, but when they lay down their arms and surrender on assurances that they may have food for their women and children, and then find that this worst instrument of attack on them is maintained, then hate never dies. On the 7th of May 1919, at Trianon Paris Hotel, which is part of the site complex, Clemenceau, Wilson behind him, handed the Germans the terms of peace. "The hour has struck for the weighty settlement of your account," said Clemenceau. "You've asked for peace. We are ready to give you peace. At a price." As the German Foreign Minister Ulrich von Rockdorff-Rantzau read his reply to Clemenceau, he remained seated and refused to stand. He's actually an old and sick person at that time. It wasn't easy for him to stand. They kept insisting he must stand to read his statement, and he did not. He said, "We can feel all the power of hate. We must recount in this assembly. It is demanded of us that we admit ourselves to be the only ones guilty of this war. Such a confession in the mouth would be a lie. We are far from declining any responsibility for this great world war, but we deny that Germany and its people are alone guilty. The hundreds of thousands of non-combatants who have perished since 11 November by reason of the blockade were killed with cold blood after adversaries had conquered and victory had been assured to them. Think of that when you speak of guilt and punishment." When he heard this bristling German defiance, Clemenceau's face turned magenta, which is like dark purple. Lloyd George snapped the ivory paper knife he was holding and said, "It's hard to have to listen to that." Wilson exploded. "What abominable manners. The Germans really are a stupid people. Isn't it just like them?" He blurts out to Lloyd George. Said Balfour, "Beast they were and beast they are." This is what propaganda can do to people. The people who produced Handel and Bach and Mozart, Martin Luther, beasts, abominable people, stupid. People who led the world and everything from automobile engines and so on, they're stupid beasts. That's the mentality. Still the Germans refused to sign. "What hand would not wither that binds itself in us in these fetters?" Chancellor Philip Scheidemann resigned his office rather than sign. But with family starving, Bolshevik uprising in Munich, Cologne, Berlin and Budapest, Trotsky's Red Army driving into Europe, Czechs and Poles ready to strike Germany from the east, Marshal Foch preparing to march on Berlin at the head of an American, French, British army, the German government capitulated. Remember the background, the context of the sign is, this is immediately after the Bolshevik Revolution. There's a civil war in Russia, and Bolsheviks are moving in. It was a death sentence for a nation. This is the sign. 5 years to the day after Gavrilo Princip shot the Archduke and his wife in Sarajevo, German delegates signed what Wilson promised his country would be peace without victors or vanquished. A huge crowd and two German delegates led like felons into the room to sign their doom. That's how one American observer in the Hall of Mirrors described that day. It was like the execution of a sentence. Please have a seat. You can see what the seats are like and what's for the meals. You've got everything from shackles and poison and... that's what it would have been like. The New York Times' Charles Selden wrote, "The stillest 3 minutes ever lived through were those in which the German delegates signed the peace treaty today." And the crowds that came for the peace signing, and a cannon was fired to announce the signing of the peace treaty, and there were celebrations and vast amounts of drunkenness that day. But what were they celebrating? They were celebrating an assassination. The same day, 28th of June, the government of the new Czechoslovak democracy sent a wire, telegram, to the leaders of Yugoslavia, congratulating them on the anniversary of the Sarajevo murder of the Archduke and his wife, and expressing the hope of similar heroic deeds in the future. What is heroic but throwing a grenade into an open carriage and shooting a man and a woman who are there in an open carriage, who just visited the hospital, by the way? By forcing German Democrats to sign the Treaty of Versailles, which disarmed them, divided them and disassembled the nation that Bismarck had built up, the Allies discredited the German Republic and democracy at its birth. At Scapa Flow, the naval base of the British Grand Fleet in Orkneys, northeast of Scotland, where the High Seas Fleet had been interned, Admiral Ludwig von Reuter, rather than surrender his warships, ordered them scuttled. with a signal from the flagship at noon on 19th of June, the day after, just a few days before they were going to be forced to sign, German sailors pulled the Seacock, sending 10 battleships, 9 armored cruisers, 8 heavy cruisers, 50 torpedo boats, 100 submarines to the bottom. And many of them are still there. Now, you would have thought the British sailors would have looked and saluted the brave sailors of the German High Seas Fleet, who did what the British would have done in the same circumstance, surely. But as the unarmed German sailors fled in lifeboats, they were fired on by enraged British sailors. This is the power of propaganda, to demonize your enemy so that you don't even feel any human sympathy for people who have done a hard thing, abandoned their ships, the ships are going down, they're now in lifeboats and they're coming, law of the sea, what do? You help people who are at risk in the sea. And yet they opened fire and murdered unarmed German seamen during a time of peace for doing a noble thing of not letting their warships fall into the hands of the enemy. Not until 12th July 1919, that's 2 weeks after the signing of the hideous Versailles Treaty, only then did the Allies fully lift the starvation blockade. When Admiral von Reuter returned to Wilhelmshaven 1920, thousands of Germans thronged the docks to hail him as the last hero of the High Seas Fleet. The Germans felt utterly betrayed, and they blamed America. President Wilson is a hypocrite, and the Versailles Treaty is the vilest crime in history, said the Social Democrat, he's a leftist, Scheidemann, who had brought down his government rather than sign. If these are the peace terms, then America can go to hell, said General Ludendorff. Now, why are they blaming President Wilson? Because it was on his promise that they laid down their weapons when they were victorious. They hadn't been beaten, there wasn't a foreign troop on their soil. They lay down on the basis of no victors, no vanquished, no portion of territory, no portion of blame, no reparations, self-determination of peoples. And they said yes. That's in fact exactly what the Kaiser offered in 1915, 1916 anyway. Now, many believe in the rule of law, believe in the sanctity of a contract. Your word is your word. Your word is your bond. You say what you mean what you say. But a contract in which one party is not allowed to be heard and is forced to sign at the point of a gun is invalid. I mean, if somebody holds you up and forces you to give your PIN for your bank card, what's the first thing you can do when you get home? Cancel the bank card. Try and reverse the... Because it's not of your free will that you gave him the PIN code to your bank card. It was at the point of a knife or a gun. And so Germany signed the Treaty of Versailles only when threatened that should she refuse it, the country would be invaded and the people further starved. Though Napoleon's foreign minister Talleyrand had been invited to Vienna to negotiate the peace of Europe, no German had been invited to participate in designing the treaty in Paris. Francesco Nitti, the prime minister of Italy when Versailles was signed, in his book The Wreck of Europe, expressed his disgust at the injustice. Remember, Italy fought on the side of the Allies in the First World War. In the old canon law of the church, it's laid down, everyone must have a hearing, even the devil. Etiam diabolus auditor. Even the devil has a right to be heard. This was understood. Doesn't matter how guilty you think the person, he's still got a right to a defense and to be heard, due process of law and so on. That's in the Dark Ages. But now the new democracy, which proposed to install the society of the nations, did not even obey the precepts of the dark Middle Ages held sacred on behalf of the accused. The accused had no rights. From the hour of signature, the Germans never felt bound. Torvalds, the unofficial voice of Berlin, said, "We must never forget it's only a scrap of paper. Treaties based on violence can keep their validity only so long as the force exists. Do not lose hope, the resurrection day comes." When people extort you, it doesn't mean that when you're out of their grip that you won't call for the police, the law, try and reverse things, try to get back what has been stolen from you. The British went from having one-fifth of the world's land surface to having one-fourth of the world's land surface and one-fourth of the world's population, the largest empire in the history of mankind. Lloyd George had wanted a peace that would enlarge the British Empire, satisfy the press, have the jingoes cheering him in the house, eliminate Germany as a commercial rival and as a world power. And he got all of it. He got the High Seas Fleets of Germany. He got the Kaiser's colonies. He got the German merchant marine. He got the promised full reparations. And then there were the French ambitions. France had lost 1,375,000 soldiers and millions more wounded, maimed or crippled. She demanded crippling compensation and terms of peace that would guarantee that Germany would never again be able to resist France. Now bear in mind, France had been the greatest threat to peace in Europe for most of Europe's history. France was the one invading everyone. I mean, this is what Britain spent most of its time fighting the French. My father's comments as a member of the 8th Army and the Royal Artillery for 6 years, I can't believe we ended up wasting our time fighting with the French twice. Because to the average Englishman, France was the enemy. France and Britain had always been enemies. Crecy, Agincourt, I mean, this is what the Napoleonic Wars were about. Napoleon and the French were the biggest threats of Europe. They were rampaging over all of Europe. They took everything, from Spain all the way through to Moscow. And so France was considered the great threat. France had declared war on Germany in 1817, when they had the Franco-Prussian War. And they mobilized against Germany before Germany mobilized against them. So mobilization, declaration of war, effectively. That was the way it worked then. And so France is acting like they were the victim. If they had managed to win, they would have been very happy to steal what they could. But the fact that they hadn't won, they needed the British and the Americans to be able to get them out of it. They never managed to win the war. They managed to lose it. And it was without the British and French, Paris would have fallen. But they wanted Germany to never be able to resist them again. Clemenceau wanted to detach all German lands west of the Rhine and create a Rhinish Rhineland, a buffer state, to occupy the east bank of the Rhine River with Allied troops for 30 years. Poitiers, Lorena, wanted to annex all 10,000 square miles of the Rhineland, as did Marshal Fox. Annexing the Rhineland would have put 5 million Germans under permanent French control, as well as much of Germany's industrial might. Like, you know, if you took the whole of Gauteng and gave it to your enemy, something like that. Wilson recoiled at so flagrant a violation of the principle of self-determination. Here you can see German wording, German everything, with French cavalry going through their town. This is in the Rhineland. And there we've just been talking about Germany. After Germany mounted the scaffold came the turn of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Under the treaties of Saint-Germain and Trianon, which is also part of the side, but from slightly distinguished between the halls, even at the same treaty basically. The ancient empire was butchered. Österreich, the Eastern Empire, which had protected Europe from the Muslim Turks for centuries, was to be butchered, distributed to nations that support the Allies. Northern provinces went to New Poland. Czechoslovakia, which had emerged as a new state, never existed before, doesn't exist now, ceded rule over 3.5 million Germans, 3 million Slovaks, 1 million Hungarians, 500,000 Ruthenes, and 150,000 Poles. All of them resented and varying degrees being forced to live in a country dominated by 7 million Czechs. Czechs weren't even a majority in their own country. This is what the Austro-Hungarian Empire looked like if you look at it in terms of ethno-linguistic groups. The red being the Germans there, the green being the Hungarians, and so on. That's a racial division of Austro-Hungarian Empire. To coerce over 3 million Germans to come under Czech rule, which most of them despised, was fiercely argued at Paris. March 10th, the chief of the field mission for the U.S. delegation, Archibald Coolidge, called it a grave mistake and filed a memorandum in which he proposed the frontier almost the same as that established in 1938 after the Munich conference, which has been so often derided because the British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, agreed to Germany getting back those territories where Germans were the majority in Czechoslovakia, which was an injustice that everyone recognized at the time that was made. Munich wasn't betrayal. It was righting a wrong done 18 years before. Coolidge's reasoning was as follows. To grant to Czechoslovakia all the territory they demand would not only be an injustice to millions of people unwilling to come under Czech rule, but would also be dangerous, perhaps fatal, for the future of this new state. In Bohemia, the relations between Czechs and Germans have been growing steadily worse during the last 3 months. The hostility between them is now intense. The bloodshed on March the 3rd when Czech soldiers in several towns fired on German crowds was shed in a manner that's not easily forgiven. It was a disastrous decision. South Africa's Jan Smuts also warned that the Czech lust for land, Hungarian as well as German, might bring disastrous results. With some millions of Germans already included in Bohemia in the north, and a further inclusion of some 500,000 Magyars, that's Hungarians, in the south, would be a very serious matter for the young state, besides a grave violation of the principles of nationality, self-determination, and God. Isaiah 10 verse 2 says, to rob the needy of justice, to take what is right from the poor of my people, that widows may be their prey and that they may rob the fatherless. That's what decided. The big four, the big fours, America, Britain, France, and Italy, did not heed Smuts and Coolidge's warnings. They listened instead to Edward Bernays, the Czech foreign minister, later to become the president of Czechoslovakia. On the eve of Munich 1938, Lloyd George would charge Bernays with having deceived the Allies at Paris. Lloyd George supported Chamberlain's handing back those territories that had been stolen from Germany at Versailles in Czechoslovakia. Proverbs 19:5 says, a false witness will not go unpunished, and he who speaks lies will not escape. So why did the Czechs succeed at Paris at the expense of their neighbors? Well, first of all, they've chosen the winning side. Secondly, the new territories had come at the expense of Germany, Austria, and Hungary, who were to be punished and weakened. No pity must be shown to Hungary, said André Tardieu, the father of Trianon, who chaired the committee dealing with the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Czechs knew what they wanted. They were resolute and ruthless in taking it. And as Hungary and Austria were reeling in shock in 1918 by the collapse of their governments, Czech troops moved into Slovakia and just seized it. They then seized the Polish enclave of Czesin, whose coal heated the foyers and powered the industry of Central Europe from Krakow to Vienna. They occupied German Bohemia, which soon would become known as the Sudetenland. This is German-majority territory that was forced into Czechoslovakia. And, as I said, Czechoslovakia never existed before, doesn't exist now. Clemenceau supported the Czech seizures. By the time Masaryk, Venice, and the Allies were finished, they created a new Czechoslovakia, the 10th most industrialized nation on Earth, because they'd just stolen from Austria and Hungary 70 to 80% of their industry. From China and glass factories to sugar processors to the breweries of Pilsen and the Skoda Works, producing the world-class armaments, locomotives, autos, and machinery. These were German, Austrian-German areas. So Adolf Hitler wasn't a revolutionary. Bear in mind, he was born in the Austrian Empire in these very areas. He just wanted to return what had always been in the hands of the Austrians. You shall not covet your neighbor's house or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Czechoslovakia became a powder keg that would ignite new wars. The new nation, one-half Czech, one-fourth German, with Slovaks and Hungarians constituting a fifth of the population, was bordered by four nations, Austria, Germany, Hungary, and Poland, all of which bore deep grievances against their territorial thefts. The country was doomed before it started. The peace conference, wrote David Handelman in A Shattered Peace, had turned Czechoslovakia into a polyglot highway from Germany to the Balkans with a fifth column in its midst. How could it stand? Getting treasures by a lying tongue is the fleeting fancy of those who seek death. South Tyrol, to the bitterness of the 200,000 Austrian immigrants, was turned over to Italy. This is Tyrol here. And this area, which explains why in The Sound of Music they've got a naval captain, you think, but Austria is a landlocked country. Well, it wasn't always. Their navy defeated the Turks at one of the greatest sea battles in history, Lepanto, which saved Europe from Turkish invasion. Austria used to have a phenomenal navy. But to deny Austria a navy, they gave their access to the sea to the Italians, who already had access to the sea, but just to deny Austria access to the sea. Vienna, seat of one of the greatest empires of Christendom, became the capital of a tiny landlocked country of fewer than 7 million people. There was a time when Austria was the greatest empire in the whole of Europe. Hungary, however, was another victim of every sort of prejudice, design, ultimate diplomatic and political error of the powers gathered in Paris, and there was no advocate. Nobody spoke up for Hungary. By the Treaty of Trianon, signed, and Trianon, remember, was also part of Versailles, signed the 4th of June 1920, Hungary was mutilated. The kingdom was reduced from a great imperial domain of 125,000 square miles to a landlocked nation of 36,000 miles square. Transylvania and the 2 million Hungarians residing there went to Romania as a reward for joining the Allies. I often wondered why I met so many Hungarians in Romania, in Western Romania, when I discovered when I studied this treaty. Slovakia was handed over to the Czechs. Other Hungarian lands went to the Kingdom of the Serbs, the Croats, and the Slovenes. Yugoslavia, a country which never existed before and doesn't exist now either. Just a creature of Versailles to punish Austria. Hungary, which might have played a key role in Clemenceau's cordon sanitaire, instead became a victim on every side. The US Congress refused to approve the Treaty of Trianon and in August 1920 signed a separate peace. Hungarians still regard the imposed peace of Trianon as a national crucifixion, as you can see with this painting here. The greatest national disaster to Hungary since the Battle of Mohawks in 1526, where the king was killed and Budapest was looted and 200,000 of the people were led into slavery, which led to a century and a half of Muslim Ottoman Turkish occupation. They said this is the worst disaster in a nation's history since the Battle of the Mohawks in 1526. On February the 1st, 1918, Wilson promised the world there shall be no annexations, no contributions, no punitive damages. People are not to be handed about from one sovereignty to another by an international conference. Self-determination is not a mere phrase. Every territorial settlement involved in this war must be made in the interest and for the benefit of the population concerned, not as part of any mere adjustment or compromise of claims amongst rival states. That's what he promised. That's what he betrayed. What Wilson promised to the world and those nations who laid down their arms would not happen is exactly what happened with his collusion. Joseph Cardinal Mensetsky, the primate or religious leader of Hungary, looked back in his memoirs upon the injustice done to his people at Paris. Beneš and Masaryk had showed fraudulent maps and made up statistics to the other delegates of the conference, and President Wilson had proclaimed the right of self-determination. But this principle was completely ignored when allies locked off two-thirds of Hungary. Nobody bothered to ask their people what their wishes were. Of the 18 million people under Hungarian rule in 1910, 10 million were taken away. Of the lost 10 million, at least 3 million were ethnic Hungarians. Hungarian bitterness about the Wilsonian peace was as deep as it was in Germany. This is why Hungary was one of Germany's allies in the Second World War. You can see, every neighbor of Germany basically benefited from stealing some parts of their territory. At Paris, Germans, Hungarians, Austrians had no right of self-determination. Germans were handed over to Denmark, Belgium, France, Italy, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and Lithuania without their consent. Plebiscites were granted to people who wanted to break free of German rule, but in Alsace, Lorraine, and Danzig, and the Corridor, and Memel, and Bohemia, and South Tyrol, Germans were denied any plebiscite or voice to choose which nation they want to belong to. 3 million Hungarians had been forced marched into other nations. By 1920, 885,000 Hungarians were under Czech rule, 1.7 million under Romanian rule, 420,000 under Serb rule. Interesting, in Romania, the man who started the revolt that led to the Christmas revolution in Romania to overthrow the dictatorship of Ceausescu was a Hungarian reformed pastor. I often wondered, why is there a Hungarian reformed pastor? In fact, they were some of the strongest churches in the eastern part, in the western part of Romania. These were all artificial countries that could not last. The little entente of Romania, Czechoslovakia, and Yugoslavia was created partly out of fear of Hungary, whose lands and people each one had stolen. And although it was promoted by an ally with France, serious statesmen like George Kennan regarded it with scorn. The little entente on which the Czechs with French encouragement have tried to base their security was an artificial, unwise arrangement, founded in the quicksands of the vengeful, emotional, unrealistic spirit that dominated French policy in the wars in the years just after the First World War. As for the newborn nations created at Paris, they were almost as multi-ethnic as the old Habsburg Empire of Austria, but lacked their lineage, history, moral authority. Czechoslovakia is only half Czech. Germans, Slovaks, Hungarians, Poles, and Ukrainians have been handed over to Prague. See Yugoslavia here. Here's Yugoslavia. It was Serbia who started the war, was rewarded by being given six other nations. Vast amounts which don't exist anymore. Yugoslavia includes Slovenia, Croatia, Montenegro, Bosnia, Macedonia. The kingdom of the Serbs, the Croats, and the Slovenes contained Bosnian Muslims, Montenegrins, Hungarians, Bulgarians. The last were forcibly transferred to the New Kingdom by the Treaty of Neuilly. Why? Well, because the Bulgarians were on Germany's side in the First World War. So punish them, give a whole lot more of their people over to be ruled by Serbia, who started the war in the first place. Poland was a polyglot nation. In a 1931 linguistic census, Poles formed only 68% of the total population. Ukrainians were 13.9%, Yiddish-speaking Jews 8.7%, Belarusians 3.1%, Germans 2.3%. Minorities made up about one-third of the population, in specific areas of a dominant majority. Woe to him who builds his house by unrighteousness and his chambers by injustice. Jeremiah 22:13. Like the Czechs, the Romanians would emerge as one of the great winners of Paris. Wedged between the Allies, Serbia and Tsarist Russia and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Romania began the war as a neutral. But in August 1916, after receiving a secret offer of Transylvania and the Benelux to be taken from Hungary, Bucharest joined the Allies. This is how the British got the Italians to change from being a German-Austrian ally to being a British ally, because they said, we'll give you Tyrol if you'll join us. Now, it's one thing to offer something from yourself, but to offer something that doesn't even belong to you doesn't seem particularly honest. And so Romania was offered vast amounts of Hungary if they would join them. Prime Minister Ian Bretenau, who had negotiated the secret treaty, had been assured of Russian military aid, which never came. By year's end, 1916, Austro-Hungarian German armies occupied Bucharest. Not until the final weeks of the war did Romania rejoin the struggle. Yet Bretenau and Queen Maria, and this Queen Maria is actually a granddaughter of Queen Victoria, first cousin of George V, she arrived in Paris to demand full payment for having fought on the side of the Allies, although Bucharest had actually violated Article 5 of the 1916 treaty by concluding a separate peace. And so this was Romania, the yellow part. This big blue part is what was just added to them out of Hungary as a reward for having fought on the side of the Allies. Between them, Bretenau and Queen Maria succeeded in doubling the size of Romania. They received Transylvania, which, by the way, is where Dracula came from. The Eastern Banat from Hungary, Bessarabia from Russia, Northern Dobruja from Bulgaria, and Bukovina from dismantled Habsburg Empire. Western Banat went to the Kingdom of the Serbs, Croats and Slovenes, what we call Yugoslavia, polyglot nation, 43% Serb. So the Serbs who ran it were even a minority. 23% Croat, 8.5% Slovene, 6% Bosnian Muslim, 5% Macedonian, 3.6% Albanian, and the rest Germans, Hungarians, Jews and Gypsies, planting the seeds of a second European war. So it was that the men of Paris redrew the maps of Europe and planted the seeds of a second European war, which would be even more vicious. The winners of Paris were the Czechs, the Romanians, the Poles and the Serbs. They all gained at the neighbours' expenses. The losers were the Austrians, the Germans, the Hungarians, the Bulgarians, the Ukrainians and the Russians. The Italians also felt cheated of what they'd been promised in the Treaty of London. They hadn't been given all that they'd been promised. The Poles felt they'd been denied Cheshire because of favoritism to the Czechs. And thus, Europe was now even more divided between satisfied powers and frustrated powers, determined to retrieve lands and peoples, which had been stolen from them. This is why we call it the most disastrous treaty in history. With the treaties of Versailles, Saint-Germain, Trianon, and Neuilly, the Allies at Paris have made a chaotic recipe for war in Europe. For America, these treaties had stripped the Great War of any morality. When Wilson came home with a peace that denied the defeated this right of self-determination, made a mockery of his 14 points, honored secret treaties that he had denounced, enlarged the British Empire, the French Empire, the Italian Empire, and the Japanese Empire by a million square miles and tens of millions of subjects, Americans concluded their 116,000 sons died for nothing. So why did America interfere in Europe's war? In world crisis, Winston Churchill himself would express puzzlement as to why the Americans ever went to war at all. That's rich coming from the man who engineered it. He, as First Lord of the Admiralty, organized the sinking of the Lusitania in order to bring the Americans to the war. There's the secret treaties. They hid this for 60 years. It came out finally that First Lord of the Admiralty had been in negotiation with Woodrow Wilson's government. How can we get you into war? Well, Woodrow Wilson says 85% of our population is against getting to war. This was the founding principle of America. This is what their first president said. George Washington, never get involved in Europe's wars. Avoid entangling alliances and so on. And that's the way 85% of Americans felt. And Woodrow Wilson started the whole propaganda industry. He started the Committee for Public Information. He got all these things organized, the brainwashing people in America with films and false information. But he needed atrocities. And so he spoke to Winston Churchill, and they organized together. They have to sink a ship that's got a lot of Americans on it. There's got to be a lot of loss of life in order to justify. And the engineering of it, it's the scandal of the Lusitania. I remember reading this when I was just 15. One of the first things that popped the bubble of thinking that our guys were the good guys and never did anything wrong. American historians will perhaps be somewhat lengthy as to explaining to posterity why the United States entered the Great War on the 6th of April, 1917. There were plenty of reasons of high policy for America staying out of the war in 1917 after waiting so long. Well, history's proven them right on that point. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. Exodus 23:2. Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister, sensed the tragedy the Allies were setting in train, perhaps with Burke in mind, who had said magnanimity, or gracious generosity, in politics is not seldom the truest wisdom. In other words, the best policy is to be generous, to be gracious. He retired to Fontainebleau in the last weekend of March and wrote one of the most prophetic documents of the century. You may strip Germany of her colonies, reduce armaments to a mere police force, and a navy to that of a fifth-rate power. All the same, in the end, if she feels that she has been unjustly treated in the peace of 1919, she will find means of exacting retribution from the conquerors. Injustice, arrogance displayed in the hour of triumph will never be forgotten or forgiven. I am therefore strongly averse to transferring more Germans from German rule to the rule of some other nations than can possibly be helped. I cannot conceive of any greater cause of future war than that the German people, who have certainly proved themselves one of the most vigorous, powerful races in the world, should be surrounded by a number of small states, many of them consisting of people who have never previously been able to set up a stable government for themselves, but each of them containing large masses of Germans clamoring for reunion with their native land. I had people ask me, why did German soldiers fight? Why was someone as honorable as Erwin Rommel fighting for Germany? Didn't he realize Hitler's evil? Didn't he realize Germany is wrong? But I understand the Versailles Treaty, I understand why people were fighting. It was ensuring war, not peace. About the creation of a Polish corridor severing Germany in two, Lloyd George warned the proposal of the Polish Commission that we should put 2 million Germans under the control of a people that are of a different religion and which has never proved its capacity for stable self-government throughout its history must, in my judgment, lead sooner or later to a new war in the east of Europe. Rather than loosening the bonds that Bismarck had forged amongst Germans, the Peace of Versailles reinforced the spirit of nationhood. The treaty defeated its own purpose. John Laughlin said it made the Germans a victim of a great injustice. The debt itself, the war reparations, which obviously fell uniformly on the whole nation, now made Germans feel solidarity for one another. They became united in a common protest. It made Bavarians and Saxons feel for the territorial losses of Prussia, whereas 50 years previously, such losses would have only concerned the Prussians, not the Bavarians. The reparations which Germans had to pay the French united them in common resentment. At Paris, the Allies had scourged Germany, dispossessed of her territory, her industry, her people, her colonies, her money, and her honor, by forcing her to sign the war guilt lie. But they hadn't killed her. She was alive. She was united. She's more populous and potentially powerful in France, and her peoples were now possessed of a burning sense of betrayal. This is a pretty good cartoon of it. Ganging up on Germany, step up to the guillotine. Novelist Anatole France wrote, as he saw victory with America's entry into the war, even if beaten, Germany will pride itself in having resisted the entire world. No other people will be so inebriated by their defeat. Versailles lit the fuse for World War II. The Treaty Rights of Versailles wrote the last act of the Great War and the first act of the coming War of Retribution. Even this hour, some men saw what was coming. Lloyd George in his front and blue memorandum. John Maynard Keynes, as he scribbled notes of his economic consequence of the peace, the first whistleblower. Marshall Fox, this is not peace, it's an armistice for 20 years. And even Jan Smuts, this treaty breathed a poisonous spirit of revenge which may yet scorch the fair face, not of a corner of France, but of all of Europe. Acquitting the guilty, condemning the innocent, the Lord detested both. God is a God of justice. When people say, why are these things happening? How can this happen? Just look at what has been done. What we sow is what we reap. Versailles threatened civilization. U.S. Secretary of State Lansing said of the peace treaty that he and Woodrow Wilson had brought home, the Versailles Treaty menaces the existence of civilization. In Italy, the wounded war veteran, fascist leader Benito Mussolini warned, the dilemma is this, treaty revision or a new war. Hans von Schlick of the German General Staff agreed, we must regain our power, and as soon as we do, we will naturally take back everything we lost. The side created not just an unjust, but an unsustainable peace. Wedged between a brooding Bolshevik Russia and a humiliated Germany were six new countries, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Czechoslovakia. Poland and Czechoslovakia held 5 million Germans captive. Against each of the six, Germany and Russia had a grievance. None of these little countries could defend their independence against a resurrected Germany or a revived Russia. And should Russia and Germany ever unite, no force on earth could ever save those six countries. The British Empire came out of Paris the greatest beneficiary. The Hohenzollern Empire of Germany had collapsed. The Romanovs of Russia had collapsed. The Habsburgs of Austria had collapsed. Even the Ottoman Empire had collapsed. Never before in history have four great empires collapse at one time in one year. The challenge of Kaiser Wilhelm's Germany that had surpassed British production in steel and manufacture in 1914 was history. Germany was no longer a great power or an economic threat to Britain. The High Seas Fleet, the greatest threat to the Royal Navy since the Battle of Trafalgar, had committed suicide at Scapa Flow. Britain had taken over Germany's Atlantic cables, most of the merchant fleet. Germany's island in the South Pacific now were given to Australia and New Zealand. German South East Africa had gone to South Africa. Tanganyika had become a British mandate. Cameroons and Togoland were divided between Britain and France. Mesopotamia and Palestine taken from the Turks, given to Britain. Out of the war fought to make the world safe for democracy, that's what they said. The British Empire just added almost 1 million square miles and many millions of subjects. Lord Curzon declared, the British flag never flew over a more powerful, more united an empire than ours. Britain's never had better cause to look the world in the face, never did our voice count for more in the Council of the Nations or determine the future destinies of mankind. But Psalm 37 verse 16 says, a little that a righteous man has is better than the riches of many wicked. I think Switzerland's better off than the British Empire. Swiss didn't steal anything from anyone. The British Empire at its zenith, phenomenal, stretching from Cape Town where we are, all the way up, Canada, New Zealand, all over the world, phenomenal. After the treaties of Versailles and Sevres had been imposed on the Germans and the Turks, you could walk from Baghdad and from Kuwait to Cairo, turn south, walk the whole length of Africa without needing a passport, without leaving a British protected colony or protected. You could drive from Cape Town to Cairo without a passport or go by train. The dream of Cecil Rhodes, a Cape to Cairo railroad, could now be built without asking for transit rights from any other power than a fellow member of their British Imperial Conference. 1921, Jan Smuts, now Prime Minister of South Africa, told his fellow Prime Ministers of the British Empire, emerged from the war quite the greatest power in the world, it's only unwisdom or unsound policy that could rob her of that great position. But he who passes by medals in a quarrel not his own is like one who takes a dog by the ears, or mangles with a mother bear and takes her cubs. The British gains had not come without cost. The war had proven a disaster. Norman Englewood predicted in his 1909 The Great Illusion. The total number of fatalities for the British Empire as a whole finally came out at 921,000. The originator of the Imperial War Graves Commission calculated that the dead would march abreast down Whitehall, the parade past the Centretop, the memorial for the dead, would last 3.5 days, marching 24 hours a day, non-stop, at speed. The highest casualty rate being amongst young British officers, striking home with all the leaders of Britain's great parties. Cape Town's mayor lost his son. Several of our aldermen did. At my school in Bulawayo, I looked every day. Massive, well, taller than our floor to ceiling here, boards with the names of old boys of Milton High who had died in Britain's war in France and in Belgium. Eton, the walls just full, Oxford, Cambridge, masses of them. The amount of young boys who died in the First World War. When I went to Ypres and visited the grave, just six of the graveyards, and there's 156 in 10 mile radius of Ypres, I saw the name Hammond 64 times on the walls. When I went to the War Graves Commission, they looked in the computer and said 480 Hammonds died in the First World War. 480 of our family name. British debt was 14 times what it had been in 1914. While it appeared to the world that the British Empire had made out wonderfully well, Britain had sustained losses, tangible and intangible, from which she had never recovered. It wasn't just the loss in manpower. And remember, each person who died, all the children they would have had and grandchildren would have had, also get snuffed out. So the loss is colossal. But the honour of Britain was the most shattered. Charles Mee, whose grandfather lost all 10 brothers in the war, wrote in his book on Versailles, not only had there been a collapse of the political order in Europe, but the war had discredited the rhetoric of national pride, honour and sacrifice, as well as faith in the notions of reason, progress and humanism. Not even did the notions of God or representative art or Newtonian physics seem to be in good repair. The modern Western civilization that had grown up since the Reformation was under siege from outside and from within, and offered scant support to the disintegrating political order. It was the greatest catastrophe in the history of civilization. A generation had been decimated on the battlefields of Europe. No one had seen the likes of such slaughter before. The deaths of soldiers per day in battle were 10 times greater than the American Civil War, which before this was the bloodiest conflict in the history of Christendom. There was the loss of moral authority. How could British and Europeans who had asserted, they just concluded 4 years of butchering one another with abandon, how could they assert a moral authority that gave them the right to rule other people? You see, up till then, people had respected the West. The West had come and stopped cannibalism, slavery, intertribal genocides. They were so much more moral, so much more organized, so much more efficient, so much kinder. They were Christian. And so people all over the world recognized, well, of course, the Europeans should rule. Christian, efficient, you can't beat them either. But with the Turks' defeat of the British and the French at Gallipoli, word went out to the Arab world and Asia, Europeans are not invincible. All of Western military prowess and power had been irreparably damaged in the eyes of their subject peoples, and respect for Western invincibility had been destroyed. Do not strive with a man without cause if he's done you no harm. Britain could still be ruling a large part of the world. Europe and Africa could still be in partnership. We didn't need to go through all the chaos. But the First World War destroyed the moral authority. What right do you have to rule any other people when you've just been killing your own people by the millions? It planted the seeds of revolution. Wilson's call for self-determination and Lloyd George's claims to respect the rights of small nations had been heard beyond the German, Austro-Hungarian and Ottoman empires. The genie of nationalism was now at the bottle. And Lord Balfour just promised the Jews a homeland in Palestine if they would get the Americans involved in the war. He wrote that letter to Lord Rothschild. To defeat the Turks, T.E. Lawrence had stirred the smouldering embers of Arab nationalism, and he promised the same territory that Lord Balfour promised the Jews, he promised the Arabs. And not a day passed that some popular leader didn't arrive in the lobby of Wilson's Hotel in Versailles to plead for independence for a province or a colony that he had never heard of. At Paris, British diplomat Harold Nicholson spoke of a sense of a riot in a parrot house. look at this interesting one here. But Woodrow Wilson leading the choir to sing Everlasting Peace, but Japan's got Pacific control in his back pocket, England's got Great Fleet, France's got Franco-American Alliance, Italy's got Greater Italy, and they're all singing for Everlasting Peace, but they've all got a hidden agenda. At Chasen, Woodrow Wilson returned to tell American Congress, "When I gave utterance to those words, all nations have a right to self-determination, I said them without the knowledge that nationalities exist, which are coming just day after day. The rights of all peoples to self-determination, to which the Allies paid homage at Paris, was an axe that would strike at the roots of every Western empire, including the French and the British." By the time Lloyd George returned to London, Ireland was in revolt. Rebellions had broken out in Egypt, Iraq, and India. And then there was the rise of America as a superpower. While Germany had been diminished, a more formidable rival had now arisen in America. World financial leadership had passed from Britain to the United States, who greatly profited from selling to allies while avoiding heavy combat till the summer of 1918. America showed itself to be a mighty military power. They had gone from 300,000 men in arms in 1917 to an army of 4 million. 2 million of whom had been shipped to France, where they'd been decisive in the final results. Britain's policy for centuries had been, we've got to be more powerful than the two other greatest navies in the world combined. Now, Britain stopped building warships in 1918, and the Americans had only begun, and they haven't stopped since. By 1921, the United States had become the first nation in a century to achieve naval parity with Great Britain, and they've eclipsed Great Britain's navy, which is the very reason Britain, Copenhagen, the fleets in Denmark, and blew up the French fleet and things, even when they were the Allies. They could never allow another fleet to equal them. An epic of Anglophobia broke out in America over the belief that the British Empire gorged itself in a war where 116,000 Americans had just died to make the world safe for democracy. There was disgust and disillusionment with the treaty that Wilson brought home. It deepened in the 1920s and 1930s, as every Allied power except Finland defaulted in the war debts and America fell into deep depression. And so in 1920, the Democrats who had led America into the First World War were wiped out in the elections. The Republicans won the House, the Congress, and the White House, and they enacted steep laws forbidding any sale of armaments to Europe, any involvement in wars, any sending American troops across the seas again. And this explains a whole lot of other things. You can see the blue here represents those states that are Republican. The anger against Democrats for, and if you've ever looked at the amount of people who have died in Democratic wars, Democratic Party of America, everything from the First World War, the Second World War, the Vietnam War, the Korean War, all Democrat wars, and vast damage. But the greatest loss Britain suffered was an astounding incredibility with American people. After Versailles enlarged the British Empire, the Allies walked away from the war debts, mocking Uncle Sam as Uncle Sherlock. Americans came to believe they'd been hoodwinked and swindled. They came to agree with the British historian H.A.L. Fisher in Versailles that Versailles had draped the crudity of conquest in the veil of morality. It's a sham. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. We read in James 3:14. France and Britain got the peace they wanted. 20 years later, they would get the war they had invited. And the next time Britain rang for help, America would take a time answering the call. The Yanks would not be coming over until France had been overrun, Britain had been thrown off the continent of Dunkirk, because America's bitterness at the belief they'd been played for fools was something the British never understood. Britain had cut the transatlantic cables. The Lusitania had been carrying military contraband. The tales of German atrocity in Belgium had been lies. The British had sent black and tans to shoot down Irish patriots. Americans had been deceived by lying British propaganda into sending our boys into a war to pull Britain's chestnuts out the fire. These are just quotes of American opinions. And something new and ominous had come out of the war. The Russia of the Romanovs was gone. Atop the largest nation on earth was a grisly gang of Bolshevik terrorists committed to world revolution and the destruction of all Western empires and nations. While the Christians of the West were busy killing one another, something new and more sinister than the world had ever seen before had arisen. in March 1920, after a trip to Europe, Churchill was warning in what Lloyd George called one of the great prophetic doctrines of European history, that we must have peace with the German people and war on Bolshevik tyranny. Interesting that Churchill saw this. We may be within measurable distance of a universal collapse and anarchy across Europe and Asia. You ought to tell France that we will make a defensive alliance with her against Germany, if and only if she entirely alters her treatment of Germany. Next, you should send a great man to Berlin to help consolidate the anti-Spartacist, anti-Ludendorff elements into a strong left-center bloc. You need two levers. First, food and credits, which must be generously accorded in spite of our own difficulties, otherwise it will worsen. Secondly, early revision of the peace treaty by a conference to which the new Germany shall be invited as an equal partner in rebuilding Europe. Because red revolutions were filling the vacuums in Central Europe. They should have seen this. What alarmed Churchill was the prospect of civil war in Germany leading to a dictatorship of left or right. Communist coups had briefly succeeded in Budapest, Bavaria, and in Berlin. And these had only been suppressed by the German Freikorps, the German Free Corps. There was a fear that there could be a dictator rising, because you take the Kaiser down, who's going to fill the vacuum? You've got to think about this. There was a communist threat to all of Europe. This is in Berlin, a communist rally in 1918. This is the backdrop. The communist threat was real. They just killed the Tsar's whole family. They were murdering millions in Russia. That's the context. And the Kapuch, the attempt to seize power in Berlin in 1920, was blocked only by a general strike. Germany was so prostrate she could no longer fulfill her ancient duty to protect Europe, Central Europe, from the Russians. Yet Churchill recognized the danger of the regime of Lenin and Trotsky. He repeatedly urged the Allies to kill the viper in its crib. So accurate was Churchill on this threat that a subsequent support of Stalin seems inexplicable and inexcusable. It's not that he didn't recognize, he suppressed his principles when it came to make an alliance with Stalin. It was a Carthaginian peace. The world's been thrust into ruin. And he laid responsibility for the vindictive treaty at the foot of Woodrow Wilson, making the world safe for democracy. I wonder whether in this reactionary peace, the most reactionary since Scipio Africanus dealt with Carthage, Wilson still hears the mute appeal of the people to be saved from the coming war. What a ghastly tragedy this is. Carthage. Torched, pillaged, its soldiers put to sword, its women violated, its children sold into slavery, banished from history. Is this to be the fate of Eastern Europe? There is a way that seems right to demand, but its end thereof is the way of death. You've got to recognize that Germans were seen as liberators in Eastern Europe. That's what I learned when I started ministering across Romania and Bulgaria and Hungary. To understand the German outrage, see it through their eyes. They weren't defeated on 11th November 1918 when they laid down the arms. Not an Allied soldier stood in German soil. They had liberated a vast swathe of territory, liberating everywhere from Ukraine, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. In the east, the map to the military situation showed the Germans all the way down to the Don, the Rostov. They'd liberated the whole of Ukraine. And yet, the sign the Allies handed all back to the Soviets. And tens of millions died as a result of the revision of Brest-Litovsk. German troops held the Crimea. They were stationed Transcaucasia between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, just north of Turkey. Germany had just applied to the prison house of nations in the Russian Empire, the Wilsonian principle of self-determination. They let the captive people go free. They did not do much different from the map, from what the map looks like now. Finland today is free. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Belarus, Ukraine. These areas, and Georgia even, which are countries that Germany gave freedom to in 1918. But the Allies reversed it, and the people suffered another 70 years of hell under communism as a result of the Allied Versailles Treaty reversing the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Germany accepted an armistice on the basis of 14 points, which were all violated, every one of them. Every single one of these points had been violated by Wilson. He called in point one, open covenants, openly arrived at, but he was happy to honor all the secret treaties that he condemned. Secret treaties with Japan, secret treaties with Italy, handing over these territories without concern. Freedom of the seas was abandoned. Point to absolute freedom for navigation seas and peace and war. Dropped. Double standards at every point. Removal of all economic barriers. Establishment of equality of trade conditions amongst all nations. But Germany was denied the right to enter into customs union with Austria. Forced to grant unrestricted allied access to her markets. Denied equal access to allied markets. Armaments reduced to the lowest level. But the Allies never demobilized the huge armies. Hitler would use the Allied refusal to match German disarmament to justify German rearmament in 1935. Wholesale theft of territories. Free, open-minded, absolutely impartial adjustment of all colonial campaigns and claims. Trampled underfoot. The Allies scrambled to seize and confiscate and steal every bit of colony, even private property. Expropriation without compensation. Better is a little with righteousness than vast revenues without justice. Proverbs 16:8. The worst was the violation of self-determination. And that's why the Austrians considered Wilson a liar and a hypocrite. They betrayed millions. And all of this ensured conflict with Germany and with Russia in the future. Destruction comes when they seek peace, but there will be none. Fraud and failure. There wasn't a treaty or promise or point made by Woodrow Wilson that wasn't violated. And therefore, the joint session of Congress never did a better day's work than when they refused to ratify this treaty. It's a parody of what was actually done, all the things that he promised. There wasn't a promise Wilson made that wasn't broken. Not a principle he did not violate. The way of peace they have not known, and there is no justice in their ways. They've made themselves crooked paths. Whoever takes it away shall not know peace. Dishonorable and disastrous. And that's why the U.S. Senate refusing to enter the League of Nations, refusing the Treaty of Versailles, voting out Wilson and every one of his criminals and the whole Democratic Party, it was the right thing to do. This is a good illustration too, taking the quills of the pens and driving it into the embodiment of peace. It burdened Europe. Here's another good picture where here's the leaders of nations, Russia, Italy, Britain, France, and they're sowing seeds of future wars in the Eastern Hemisphere and the Western Hemisphere. Lloyd George said we'll have to do the whole thing again in 25 years at 3 times the cost. He's wrong. More like 30 times the cost. The dilemma was the goals were irreconcilable. You couldn't have Wilson's ideals and Fox demands. You can't have a truncated disarmed Germany weighed down with reparations. Wilson promised a peace with no victors, no vanquished. The victor can have vengeance or he can have peace, but he can't have both. A wrathful man stirs up violence. At a London dinner party after Adolf Hitler had taken power in Germany, one of the guests asked Lloyd, by the way, where was Hitler born? And the instant reply of Lady Astor was, at Versailles. Hitler was born at Versailles. Rising from obscurity, this artist and architect, to build a mass movement in a demoralized Germany, Hitler first drew public notice, then attracted an ever larger crowd by delivering again and again a powerful speech that he simply titled The Treaty of Versailles. Why was there a Second World War? What were the Germans fighting for? This is how Hitler was welcomed into the Tsar. This is how the people responded. These are people in the Rhineland welcoming Adolf Hitler in an open car. This is how German soldiers are being welcomed into Austria. You see the Austrian flags? Austrians welcoming the German army coming into Austria. This is going into Austria, the welcome for Adolf Hitler in an open car. This is not an invasion. This is a victory parade. Into Sudetenland, in what they call Czechoslovakia. Here's how the local people in what was called Czechoslovakia welcomed the German troops. You kind of see something in the pictures. The enthusiasm in Czechoslovakia, Sudetenland. Who's this? The Welsh witch, Lloyd George, one of the architects of Versailles, who said Adolf Hitler is the greatest leader of the 20th century. And praising him and saying that if Britain ever was defeated, I hope we would have someone like Adolf Hitler to raise us up again. And he supported even the reversing of Versailles, which he had drawn up himself. And here you come back to, this is the car, the railway carriage, in which the armistice was signed. It was in a museum. And so what did the Germans do after they beat the French in 1940? They brought it out of the museum, brought it back to the exact spot where they'd been forced to sign the armistice 11th of November 1918, and they forced the French to sign in that same carriage in the same place. You see symbolism. It means everything. Hitler dictates terms in 1918 coach. It was a much nicer treaty, though, than what they had signed. He didn't ask for the French Navy or anything like that. On the 8th of April 1945, Churchill in a memo to the Foreign Office traced the origins of the unnecessary war back to Versailles and to Woodrow Wilson. This war should never have come unless, under American and modernizing pressure, we had driven the Habsburgs out of Austria and the Hohenzollerns out of Germany. By making these vacuums, we gave the opening for the Hitlerite monster to crawl onto the vacant thrones. No doubt these views are very unfashionable. The men of Versailles brought home the peace of vengeance the people wanted. Their children would pay the price for their having failed to bring home the peace of justice. That price would be 50 million dead in the war that should come out of the Hall of Mirrors in the Palace of Versailles. One of my best sources for this study and presentation was Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, How Britain Lost Its Empire and the West Lost the World by Patrick Buchanan. John Maynard Keynes, Economic Consequences of Peace, excellent. Peacemakers, interesting. Versailles, The End of the War to End All Wars by Charles Mee. The Hall of Mirrors by David Sinclair. Henry Kissinger, Diplomacy. I must say he's got to be the worst source because he really liked Versailles. But you've got to know what the other side says too. Peacemaking, also not a good book. End of Order, Versailles, 1990 by Charles Mee, good book. A.J.P. Taylor, excellent book, The First World War, Understanding It. So these are, my notes are on the table. These are some of my sources. And facts are stubborn things. So any questions, any comments?
I just remember when at school we were talking about the Second World War, I mean the First World War and everything. Then they explained like what Germany had and everything. And then when we asked why did Germany's property get taken and given someone else, our teacher just told us because Germany killed a lot of people. So.
That's a Hollywood answer. Yeah, like the French and the Belgians never killed any people. Yeah, I've heard this from so many military veterans. If only we'd known what to have become of our countries, we wouldn't have fought against each other. We would have fought together, side by side. Yes, any other comments or questions?
I believe that they really wanted to start the war. Apparently there were three assassination attempts on the Archduke before they got him. The two and then the third one.
Yes.
I think it was on the same day.
Next week, I've got a much shorter presentation. It's a lot simpler. It's the assassination Sarajevo, and it's an incredible story. But that's what started the war. And most people have forgotten what started the war. But I know this is colossally big, but you see, next week, Friday, when we're having our next open day, is the 100th anniversary of the Versailles Treaty. So I want this video out and up. And I know that this is a marathon race of a huge, but a colossal subject. But next week, I also want to get out in time for the 28th, again, the assassination Sarajevo, something I dealt with 5 years ago. But to get a video of it that we can share around for people to understand exactly what led to it. And the Soviet communists who started the war, their intention, and there were a whole lot of these assassins. And there were several bomb throwing attempts earlier. And this assassin with a bullet, he's only 18 years old, assassin And he is never repentant. He died of tuberculosis or something several years later, before the end of the war. But Austrians couldn't execute him because he was underage. They couldn't give the death penalty to somebody under 20. He was 18 years old. He had just murdered a husband, wife, in cold blood, and the Austrians still didn't even execute him, which you would have thought, well, honestly, he committed an adult crime, he should take an adult penalty. But he never felt that he'd done anything wrong. That's how much they brainwashed him. This is how people, and I know we've got people like this involved in the farm tortures and the racist murders and so on. A lot of these terrorists actually think that they just, when Sean spoke to the terrorist, Kyle McComber, who machine gunned the people in St. James Church in prison, he thought he was a hero. He was a Christian who'd go to heaven because he had killed racists in the struggle. It's amazing how people's minds can be so twisted, they can be so deceived, even demon-possessed in cases, to actually believe what they're doing is right when it's absolute evil. We must never trust ourselves either. That's where we've got to bring every thought captive to the Word of God.
So was Hitler not the culprit in killing the many Jews?
Well, that's another subject. The point is, Hitler would never have had a chance to even get into power if it hadn't been for the Versailles Treaty that created the conditions of the people's frustration. And so whether you like or don't like, agree with or don't agree with, loathe or anything, you've got to recognize what Winston Churchill said, that there wouldn't have been a vacuum into which he could have stepped if they hadn't created it with this vindictive, short-sighted, counterproductive treaty. Yeah, that's a totally different story.